The YouTube video shot in your bedroom now has a slicker competitor, a homemade computer animated video made with something called Extra Normal. Nishat Kurwav, TurnstileNews.com, tracked down the people who made some of her favorite videos.
The video that put Extra Normal on the map has more than 10 million views on YouTube. Two button-nosed, Hello Kitty-like characters of indeterminate species confront each other in a static pastel scene with a lone cherry tree.
If it's not an iPhone, why would I want it?
The video takes a satirical jab at iPhone obsession. One of these beady-eyed creatures is plugging a rival smartphone brand.
Well, it's similar to an iPhone, but has a bigger screen.
I don't care.
The internet speeds are around 3 times faster.
I don't care.
It can grant up to 3 wishes, even if one of those wishes is for an iPhone.
I don't care.
With Extra Normal, anyone can make a computer animated movie.
Create a presentation for school. Be the host of a talk show.
You hop on the site and choose a background and a couple of animated actors. To cast the irrational boss or the freaky neighbor, you can pick from Lego people, robots, or a gang of regular folks. A few celebrity characters are on hand for spoofs.
Be who you want to be. Be you.
You type in the script, add some basic facial expressions and gestures, and publish to the web. An Extra Normal chief technology officer, Silvio Drun, says, you could soon find that your video has inspired some competition.
People tend to come to our website to make a movie because they've watched another movie. We never invested $1 in marketing.
Often, videos that hit the meme creation jackpot are bringing gripes before the court of public opinion.
Sisters, where are all the good black men? I just can't find one.
In this provocative short called Black Marriage Negotiations, the characters hash out tensions around black love and dating. A generic-looking black man and woman face off across a boardroom table. The woman rattles off a list of eyebrow-raising expectations, which include...
I want someone who earns 6 figures.
That's me.
A man who will pay all the bills, yet recognize I'm an independent woman.
What? How can you be independent when someone else pays all of your bills?
Daryl Lawson created the video to extend a conversation that began on his Philosophy's radio show. He figured animation could take the bite out of a contentious issue.
The pauses, the way he looks at the camera and him. So all of that lends to the comedic timing.
Even when you're writing something that's not really meant to be funny, say like this story, your video gets a humor boost from the computerized voice. An Extra Normal video can be shared more widely than a Facebook status update, requires less commitment than a blog, and packs more visual allure and nuance than a tweet. The most popular scripts have a formula. There's a wise guy who's the voice of reason and a tone-deaf argumentative partner. In this one, a professor levels with a student who's bent on applying to grad school.
You will teach 50 kids in one semester, while reading thousands of pages a week, and writing hundreds of pages for your jaded professors who are contemplating suicide daily. You will qualify for food stamps.
I will inspire students to think critically about literature.
Allison Leslie made this video instead of blogging about the frustrations of humanities studies.
Blogging can sometimes come across as ranting. And in this format, ranting turns into humor in a way that people can consume it in a positive way.
Extra Normal just hit the 2 million monthly user mark and adds about 7,000 new creators a day. For NPR News, I'm Nishat Kurwa.
Hey, that story is from TurnstileNews.com, an online news service from Youth Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Enskeep.
And even occasional viewers of primetime TV, those who barely watch TV at all, have likely seen the work of one director in particular. That's because Paris Barclay has directed old school favorites like ER and the buzziest of new shows like Glee, plus The West Wing, Lost, CSI, and others. Now he's executive producer for the show In Treatment on HBO, and NPR's Netta Ulaby has this profile.
In a dumpy, dim editing room, Paris Barclay and his editor, Joe Hoback, are intently scrutinizing a scene from In Treatment. They're looking for flaws in a scene where a teenage boy is showing his therapist pictures on a camera.
Go to the next one.
This?
Yeah.
Ew!
So that's this guy.
Wait.
On my corner.
What is that shot that's happening when he gets up and just becomes a nothing shot? What is that?
Barclay sprawled on a lumpy brown couch as if he's in therapy. He's figuring out the best shots with his editor, who's sitting in front of a TV and manipulating the editing software.
The shot basically starts here, so...
It starts there?
Well, there's a big pause before he leans in.
This is how you direct a TV show, once everything's in the can. There's a real challenge to making a therapist talking to a client look interesting. The setup's so inherently static, it's kind of a joke on set.
You can say, okay, now everybody get ready. Here comes our action sequence.
Someone's getting up off the couch.
Basically getting up and going out the door becomes the action sequence.
But Paris Barclay actually does direct action sequences in gritty police procedurals.
Grayson, get the hell down. Call for backup now.
And he's orchestrated flashy musical numbers on Glee.
Big wheel keep on turning.
And he's directed a famous West Wing walk and talk.
Porous borders between the U.S. and Canada. That's the governors of Washington.
I'm booked 6 months in advance. I'm famous for doing a lot of episode number twos. After someone has spent, like, millions on the pilot, I'm the person that they call and say, okay, we're doing the second episode, and we only have $2.95. But we want it to look exactly like the $10 to $20 million pilot.
The guy who created Glee, Ryan Murphy, has credited Barclay with helping Glee find its groove. Barclay is known for immersing himself in the visual culture of the shows he directs, the look, rhythm, language, sensibility, to bring out each show at its best.
It's not about saying, oh, this would be so fantastic in treatment. I'm going to shoot it like Quentin Tarantino would, just to show how incredibly clever I can be.
A lot of people don't understand there's not a lot of continuity in television directing.
You're in and out. It's a pretty thankless task sometimes for directors.
Kurt Sutter created the FX show Sons of Anarchy. It's a critically acclaimed series about a gun-smuggling motorcycle gang.
Got a garage full of AK-47s. Need a place to assemble and store them.
Got a strip club out on 95. Huge basement, private.
Sounds perfect.
Sutter brought in Paris Barclay to direct the third episode.
In my mind, it was the episode where I really had a sense of, okay, this is really the formula that works.
And now he's got Barclay on board as basically a director in residence.
Quite honestly, thematically, there's nobody that understands what it's more to be an outsider or an outlaw, if you will, than a gay black man.
Before Paris Barclay became the first black board member of the Directors Guild, before his Emmys and Peabody Award, he was a kid from a rough Chicago neighborhood. He won a scholarship to an elite Midwestern boarding school.
I was going to be the first black student in this very small, very white school in Indiana, which, by the way, is the home of the KKK. And I thought to myself, I need some backup. So I didn't want to go alone.
So he finagled another scholarship for his brother. In high school, Barclay developed a taste for theater. At Harvard, he wrote for Hasty Pudding shows. When he graduated in 1979, he went from advertising to directing music videos for the likes of LL Cool J. Now, Paris Barclay is one of a very few openly gay black decision makers in Hollywood. He's used to hearing the same line from other industry executives when they see scripts with characters like him.
That's just too much. Is it enough that they're just gay, or is it enough that they're just black, as if, you know, one cross is enough to bear? But if they're gay and black, I just think that's just too overwhelming.
Barclay and his husband have adopted two kids from the Los Angeles foster care system.
There's 35,000 kids in foster care, just in this sort of L.A. County region. Many of them are dark-skinned, like myself, and are not being adopted because of that. And that made me furious.
Barclay said their impulse was to adopt as many as possible.
Well, we settled on two. We thought, let's not be too ambitious. And since then, they've changed our lives.
Having kids has made Paris Barclay more interested in developing shows for tweens. He's working on a couple that take on intolerance because, he says, that's the crisis of his kids' generation. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. It's a busy weekend for television, with three new series premiering Sunday on cable and public TV. Episodes and Shameless on the Showtime cable network, and Downton Abbey on PBS. A few things about these shows should be noted at the start. They're all very well acted, cleverly written, fun to watch, and a little unusual. Not one of them comes from commercial broadcast TV, which continues to play things safe and boring this season. And, by coincidence, all of them have something to do with the United Kingdom. Downton Abbey, the latest miniseries import from what used to be known as Masterpiece Theater, is a great new period drama the way the British used to make them, back in the days of Brideshead Revisited. Shameless, a new comedy starring William H. Macy, isn't a British show, but it's an American remake of one. And Episodes, a new comedy starring Matt LeBlanc, is about a British sitcom that's being adapted for America like The Office was, and with the former star of Friends playing himself, offered the leading role. Let's start with Downton Abbey, the best imported miniseries since Bleak House. It's written by Julian Fellowes, who wrote the movie Gosford Park, and it's a kind of modern take on Upstairs Downstairs. It's got the same division between the downstairs people, the servants, and the upstairs people, their wealthy employers. Except in Downton Abbey, which takes place in the early 20th century, money is so scarce, the residents of the abbey may soon lose title to their own estate. And while the servants downstairs iron the morning newspaper so the ink won't run on the hands of the Earl of Grantham, the headlines themselves deliver some unsettling news about other people of privilege aboard the Titanic. Jim Carter plays the head butler, Mr. Carson, and Hugh Bonneville plays the Earl, who turns out to be surprisingly and endearingly sensitive.
Good morning, Carson.
Good morning, my lord.
Is it true what they're saying?
I believe so, my lord.
I'm afraid we'll know some people on it. I don't suppose there are any lists of survivors yet.
I understand most of the ladies were taken off in time.
You mean the ladies in first class? God help the poor devils below decks.
This miniseries pays equal attention down below and up above, with characters that are full of surprises and quirks, and storylines that offer the same. It's not unreasonable to expect a period drama like Downton Abbey to offer scenes of illicit romance and unexpected death. But at the same time, all that, and there's a fox hunt, too. Shameless, based on a British series that has run for 8 seasons now, stars William H. Macy as an irresponsible drunk with a bunch of kids, who cope mostly not because of him, but in spite of him. This American remake, like the original, is written by Paul Abbott. And if you've watched a lot of British imports, you know his work. The detective series Cracker, the original miniseries version of State of Play. Shameless is a comedy, but a really, really dark one. One that almost dares you to like its central character. The series is daring in other ways, too. For one thing, Macy, the star of the show, barely appears in Sunday's premiere episode, which focuses instead on his eldest daughter, played by Emmy Rossum, and the other kids. But they're strong enough to carry on without him, which in this show is the entire point. There's a similar trick pulled in the opening program of Episodes, which stars Matt LeBlanc as an exaggerated version of Matt LeBlanc. He shows up in the opening scene, but only to launch a flashback, which takes up the entire 7 episodes of the show's first limited season. He doesn't even reappear until episode 2. But as with William H. Macy in Shameless, the show works just fine until he shows up. The real focus of Episodes is on Sean and Beverly, writers of a fictional, award-winning British TV comedy, one that an American TV executive persuades them to come to America to remake because it's his favorite show. Only after they sign up and show up do they realize he's never even seen it. And in episode 2 of Episodes, when they take a courtesy lunch meeting with Matt LeBlanc, it's only because they're told he saw and loved their series while making a movie in England. It doesn't take them long to learn that's not quite true either. Stephen Mangan plays Sean, Tamsin Gregg is Sean's wife and writing partner Beverly, and Matt LeBlanc, approaching their restaurant table while talking on his cell phone, is himself. Sort of.
They're asking if we have the financing?
Screw that. Tell them we're looking at another location, and if we're not closed by the end of today, the whole thing is off the table. But, sorry. I'm trying to buy a restaurant.
I'm Beverly. This is Sean.
Hey. So, I'm here. Why?
Yeah, well, to talk about our show.
What show?
Brilliant.
Did you recently shoot a movie in England?
No.
So you're not a huge fan?
Of England?
No, of us.
Oh, you? No.
Well, this isn't at all awkward.
Let me ask you something. Would you go to a restaurant where you roll your own sushi?
Absolutely not.
See, that's what I'm afraid of. Oh, one sec.
Episodes is unexpectedly good, sharp, and funny, and knows the territory because co-creator David Crane was one of the creators of Friends. And he doesn't just focus on Matt LeBlanc either. Tamsin Gregg especially is a real joy. In fact, all three of these shows, Episodes, Shameless, and Downton Abbey, are pleasures to watch. And not one of them, it's worth reiterating, comes from the standard Hollywood system.
And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here around the table for the first time in 2011.
And for the first time in 2 weeks.
First time in 2 weeks with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. And everyone is here around the table. So, Stephen, why don't you tell the people who you are?
I am Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
And, Trey, why don't you tell the people who you are?
I'm Trey Graham. I'm the movies editor at NPR.org, and I help out a bit with the blog.
And, Glenn, who are you?
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write about comics and books for the NPR website.
That is wonderful to see everyone. How was your week away?
Oh,
lonely.
I spent it catching up with my kids on a little game called Frogger.
Oh, as we were all carefully watching.
That was a success, was it?
It was a success. I bought my kids, for those who didn't hear the last podcast, I bought them a full-sized, arcade-sized Frogger machine. Ultimately, wrapping it was a bit of a chore. It involved blankets and lots of my daughter peering around behind it, noticing the big, thick cord jutting out of the back of it, and she kept saying, I think it's an arcade game. And my son would be like, Grace, we're not supposed to know what it is.
That's exactly what he would do.
That's exactly. The boy loves rules.
Well, I'm glad to know they liked it.
Yeah, it was a humidifier. That would have been really... Hey,
kids. It's been awfully dry in the Thompson homestead these days.
Humidifier.
No more chafing.
That would have been great. Or like a really big jukebox with no records.
Yeah. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
That just be like, it's just an old-timey jukebox. It doesn't play music.
Or, you know, just a proper fridge, because ice in the door is important.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. When the kids were hankering for a third refrigerator.
Exactly what we needed. Well, anyway, I'm glad that we've all made it and that we've all returned after our week off.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I feel rejuvenated and ready to crack wise.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so relieved. So the first thing that we thought we would talk about this week is an essay in Wired magazine that Patton Oswalt wrote. One of our favorites, I think it's safe to say, much of the time.
So.
Comedian slash actor slash voice of cartoon rat.
Also an extremely gifted writer.
Absolutely.
Which is part of what makes him such a good comedian.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And he wrote an essay in Wired called Wake Up Geek Culture, It's Time to Die. And Glenn, can you give me your basic description of what the piece is about?
Okay. He starts off the piece by saying he and his friends back in the day never thought of themselves as nerds or geeks. They thought of themselves as otakus, which is a Japanese word meaning people get really obsessed about things like anime. And so just from a rhetorical perspective, saying I'm not a nerd, mm-hmm. I'm an otaku is one of those sentences that contradicts itself even as you're saying
it. You're literally a nerd.
Exactly. It's very like saying, at my college, a cappella was cool. It's one of those sentences that sort of...
Oh, it begins.
That's just unnecessary.
All right, so he has a really good point. He is about my age, so his references are my references. So as he was going through this, I found myself nodding a lot. He talked about having, as a kid, an escape hatch culture, where you kind of go along with the rest of the world, but you find these things that kind of identify you and your friends. In his case, it was Monty Python quotes. In my case, it was Monty Python quotes.
The incredibly obscure world of young dudes who like to walk around spouting Monty Python quotes. How incredibly bizarre.
But but Linda, back in 1987, Glenn and Patton Oswalt were special.
And yes, they were the only ones who were going around spouting Monty Python quotes. Need I explain... that I also knew people in 1987 who enjoyed spouting Monty Python quotes.
Oh, this is just one example of what he's saying. But he's talking about...
I'm sorry, that's right. There was also the incredibly obscure and little-known Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Yes. He said, actually, Lord of the Rings was ours and only ours because of the thickness of the books. And then he laments the fact that everybody knows the books and the stories because of the Oscars. He talks about these things like we had watchwords, like we were first century Christians with our shibboleths and our secret signs, and they weren't particularly, as you rightly say, they weren't that secret.
One of my favorite lines in this piece, actually, is where he's talking about this. He writes, "There's a chilly thrill in moving with the herd while being quietly tuned into something dark, complicated, and unknown just beneath the topsoil of popularity."
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderfully written piece.
It really is.
Much of which I take issue with to varying degrees. I actually wrote down a great line in it. Since we're still providing some background on this piece, he refers to the phenomenon of etiwaf, mm-hmm. which would be an acronym for everything that ever was available forever.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Etiwaf doesn't produce a new generation of artists, just an army of sated consumers."
That's the point that I think got distorted in a lot of the discussion of this essay. The point that he was making was slightly subtler, I think, than it was portrayed. He's talking about the longing that happened after a show ended or a movie ended that drove a sort of nerdy scholarship. You sought more information about it out. You talked to your friends about it. What he's saying now is that longing doesn't exist because it is exactly as you said, a sated consumer. That cycle of desire and gratification of finding out more about the thing.
That the obsessives were forced to extrapolate and thus create.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Whereas now it's so easy to extrapolate. First of all, there's that information is all available immediately in the form of, you know, it comes sort of geek in a box.
Right.
You know, that you can buy a box set of all the Lord of the Rings movies and it has 27 hours of extras and everything is in one place for you to discover instantly if you so desire.
Right. One of his complaints is about all those extras. Mm-hmm. And then one of his complaints is about the instant accessibility and endless accessibility,
mm-hmm.
as is sort of encoded in that abbreviation, of everything there is to have. And this I can sympathize with because, I mean, like all of you, I assume, my Netflix queue is ridiculous. And I have that 3-hour BBC Hamlet on my TiVo from what I thought was last fall, but it turns out, because I just checked, to have aired on Great Performances last April, and it's still taking up 3.5 hours of hard drive space.
Mm-hmm.
And I still haven't read A Suitable Boy, which came out in, what, the 90s?
Right.
You have, however, seen every episode of The A-List.
It is true. I watched all of The A-List.
Unsuitable Boys.
I would like to have known that I am making excellent progress on Stacey Schiff's new biography of Cleopatra.
There we go.
Phew.
So his point is that this whole thing produces weak otakus.
his words.
His very words. And so, Linda, you want to weigh in here now? You've been stingingly silent.
No, I agree with a lot of what he's saying. And we've talked, I think, on the show before about the phenomenon of the loss of nostalgic longing for things. Because it's definitely true that there used to be things that I had not seen in many, many years, and then they would pop up again. And that very rarely happens. If it was ever something that you were excited about, you will probably have it, own it, possess it, whatever.
Or at least be able to watch it on YouTube.
Well, you know, the unavailability that he's talking about creates a forced separation. And it's a sort of absence makes the heart grow fonder and curiouser. And so when there's not that forced separation, what happens? And I guess where I would take issue with it is the declaration that you can automatically know that that makes the attachment weak. I think you can say it makes the attachment different. And I definitely sympathize with him when he talks about, I want my daughter to have the same experiences of culture that I had. And everybody wants that, I think. And everybody is equally doomed in wanting that to happen. The way I felt about the piece was that it went along identifying, obviously, a very real phenomenon with a couple mm-hmm. of obvious, I think, logical fallacies, including the idea that you were passing some kind of secret sign by quoting Monty Python movies. What I think that is it made your world smaller, and therefore you were able to tell yourself that you were the only people that quoted Monty Python movies because you were the only people at your high school that quoted Monty Python movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there was a little knot of these people at every high school everywhere
mm-hmm.
makes you, in fact, not that unusual, but you don't all find each other on the internet. So you think you're more unusual than you actually are. But he goes along for a while, I think, making these points that are very, very fair. But then there is a moment to me where it tips into a rant that is less interesting. And in fact, when I'm reading it, there's a moment when I start hearing it in my Patton Oswalt voice.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And you feel like now he's tipped over into riffing.
Right.
And when he ultimately goes off the rails into this kind of, and then pop culture will melt down and, you know, things will start commenting on themselves. And it's like, where were you going with this?
Well, where did you mean to bring this?
Because you didn't go anywhere.
Right. He offers a solution, which is a goof, which is so tongue-in-cheek.
At that point,
you have to do that like that.
Yeah.
Right,
because
exactly.
it's just nothing but a well-crafted and articulate goof.
Right. This is in some ways a comedy piece. It's not
exactly
it's
right.
not
satire.
It begins as an observation and to a certain extent a critique, but it becomes satire and a comedy piece. And I think at some point he's lampooning people who like to bemoan the ubiquity of the internet.
Where I really, really agree with Trey is I think it's important not to take everything in that piece as designed to be an airtight argument.
Right. No, of course not. And I think the end of this piece,
not to drill down too deeply into the particulars of the piece, but it definitely ultimately winds up as a comedy routine.
No, of course it does. That's exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I was interested in the beginning.
You were interested in the cultural critique.
I was interested in the beginning in sort of, so where does this take you? Because to me, just sitting around moaning about the fact that everybody doesn't take in culture the same way that you do is only interesting if you're going to go somewhere with that. What does that mean to you? And I guess I felt like he sort of set up a very interesting question that he then expressed no interest in answering. And I'm not suggesting there really is an answer. Right. I wanted to sort of see where he was going with it. And right when I was kind of interested in where he was going with it, it turned into blobbity blue and you know what I mean?
his whole thing
that he does, which obviously he's wonderful at. Don't get me wrong. I am a huge admirer of the guy. I think he's a genius and he's a great writer. And it's a very well-written piece, as we've already said. Sure. And I understood it. I didn't not get that it was supposed to be funny.
Right. Right.
It's just, to me, it has a weird tonal shift in the middle that didn't completely work for me.
Well, I think what you're picking up on is the fact that it doesn't have a place to go, because at the core of this piece, underneath the eloquence, is something that is as old as nerds themselves, which is nerd entitlement, which is the sentiment of you are doing it wrong.
Right.
You do not appreciate this thing in the same way, to the same extent, and for the same reasons that I do. Therefore, you're doing it wrong. Right. And this is an endemic thing in nerd culture. It is a toxic thing, but you can't get away from it because it's usually directed, historically it was directed at normals, these jocks and these.
Right. And there's a little bit of that in the piece.
And he's doing that either 49% knowingly or 51% knowingly.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think he obviously knows he's doing it to some degree.
Sure.
That's the point where it's satirical to some degree, but he also means it. You know what I mean? Well, so it's kind of like,
there were several points in this essay where he would make an argument stating something as a bad thing, and I would either say out loud or mutter under my breath,
well,
good.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah. Good.
There was one particular thing. He talks about how nowadays the ease of access to creation tools and to lots of different inputs, his argument seems to be that nerds who yearn for more of something that is no longer being produced no longer go out and produce great works of art. Instead, they make mashups.
Right. Mm.
And what he doesn't address is the question of whether those things are valid works of art.
Look at the works of Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
I mean, Quentin Tarantino's works are in effect, mashups. Mm-hmm. But they're usually stylistically brilliant mashups that I love.
I mean, how many things
is it less
can you
valid?
Point to that are, in a sense, inspired by other things and combinations of other things and influenced by other things and culture?
Well, everything since the Epic of Gilgamesh, right?
Exactly. And I think that although he's absolutely right, I understand his whole thing about like the cheapening of YouTube clips and all that. I get all that. I get all the stuff about he doesn't like the memes and he doesn't like or he tires of the memes and the mashups and the parody songs
and the sheer din of the quantity.
And I agree with that. But I kind of agree with Trey that he doesn't address the issue of whether those things that are being created, when they're good, are a valid expression.
He talks a lot about how, because the otaku were strong, that you had more of a bonding experience and everything like that. But he obviously, he sort of refers to the internet as, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, blah, blah, blah. You know, like everything is changed entirely by the internet. But what he's describing is sort of the downside of what I think is an inherently good thing, which is that, you know, with the internet, geek culture means never being alone, never being isolated.
Right.
Being, you know, all of us who have...
Oh, thank God.
I don't know.
I'm only kidding.
No, I mean, I think all of us were at varying points in our lives felt isolated by our geekhood in one way or another. I grew up in a very small town. There were not a ton of people who were as obsessed as I was with the things with which I was obsessed. having the collective experience. On one hand, you're not this, you know, oh, shoot, you know, I was the only kid in my high school who wore keyboard ties and had the specific kind of mullet that I had.
Right.
And maybe
that
would be
the high mullet.
Yeah, and maybe I wouldn't have felt as special had I known that there was another knob in the town over
with a
keyboard tie and a mullet.
Send your pictures to I wore a keyboard tie.
Keytar. I just picture a keytar. I don't know why, but I do.
You know, that, you know, maybe on some level I would have felt like less like a unique and special snowflake had I known that there were dorks in every town just like me.
This goes exactly back to Linda's point. My thing is that the passion that drives this breed of obsessiveness is of its nature exclusive. Mm-hmm. And it was exclusive back in the day when we thought we were the only people quoting Monty Python in our schools. It is no longer exclusive because you are still building these little bubbles around you, but there's more people in the bubble.
I do think it's important when you talk about geek culture and you talk about availability to recognize that there are sort of class and availability issues involved in things like, he's talked about the fact that he grew up in Sterling, Virginia, which is outside of D.C. It's a suburb of D.C. And he has a way of sort of saying, I was so close to D.C. where all this great cool stuff was, but I was out in the suburbs where, oh my gosh, what do they have there? Well, you got to remember, it's a lot easier to be a geek in Sterling, Virginia than it is to be, for instance, a kid growing up in, let's say, a town in Ohio without an art house theater, where you really would have had no access, unless you had a particularly good blockbuster, which you probably didn't. You probably had no access to a vast array of films unless you had exactly the right
A music nerd who didn't have college radio until I was in college.
And what I'm saying is, you know, for those people, for a kid like that, for you know, a 15-year-old kid who's fascinated by, like, the French New Wave, you can live anywhere, and you can have access to Netflix and things like that just as much as you do in New York. And I think that when you look at the downside of all of this, exactly like what you're saying, Stephen, that the downside of all of this is the stuff that he mentions that's negative, and what Glenn was talking about in terms of the loss of exclusivity, which is part of what bonds you to your fellow nerds. But at the same time, there are people who would have found it really difficult to be passionate about and interested in the things that they were interested in, because when you hear people say things like, oh, when I was able to collect the entire set of blah, 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 but I had to work really hard to get it, it's like, well, not everybody has access to that stuff, both for geographical reasons and for financial reasons.
Sure.
You can get a lot more stuff for free because you can read it on the internet. And it's, like I said, I don't want to make the whole thing about that, but I think you have to acknowledge that inclusiveness and therefore loss of exclusiveness may be bad for you,
but
that it may
good
be
for
good
all those
for some of the people who are newly included.
Well, yes, and that's exactly the other point that I wanted to make. And that we touched on this a little bit in the last episode when my mom was here and sort of talking about the gifts that we got from our parents, and my parents being comic book collectors who absolutely built their entire lives around telling people about their favorite stuff, and that I like to think that I've built my entire life around telling people about my favorite stuff. And to me, the sort of social experience of sharing music I love, television I love, movies I love, and to a far lesser extent, books I love, that is a large, large part of the joy of consuming that art in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the fact that there are all these accessible entry points, which Patton Oswalt sort of says, like, it's good now that you can get into this stuff, but he has mixed feelings about it. And he actually praises the AV Club, you know, for having that gateways to geek.
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think he praises the AV Club in general, but not that feature.
But he doesn't like gateways to geek.
Yeah, he doesn't like gateways
specifically,
he likes
he
Raven.
Specifically
he
complained
like
about it because it, because, and this is where specifically he talks about weak otaku, because he says that gateway to geekery provides the opportunity for people to discover all the good stuff without having to go through the middling stuff and the lame stuff, and sort of strengthen themselves, strengthen their nerd credentials by sort of figuring out what makes good stuff.
But what drives me nuts is that's not why you consume art. I don't consume art to strengthen my nerd credentials. I consume art to... I'm not yelling at you, Trey.
No.
And you also don't consume it to prove how great you are for putting up with all the bad parts of it. And that, to me, was a really interesting point because it goes back to, you can find this with like people in a profession where you used to have to go to like 8 years of school. If they say, you know, it might be that you don't need 8 years of school, you only need 3 years of school, they will stand there saying, I don't want these new people coming up to not do what I, darn it, I went through my 8 years of school, yap, yap, yappity, yap. And it's like, it's not about them proving themselves as hard as you did. Like, if there's a way to make it easier to get to the good parts of something, I understand the whole, well, but I earned my,
but don't pull the cultural ladder up behind you.
That's exactly what it is. That is exactly what it is. And I had that same reaction. And the other point I wanted to make, Stephen, about the thing you were saying, when you talk about sharing things with other people, I think it's also important to realize that as much as it may seem like everything's available to everybody, everybody still only takes in a tiny, 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 tiny percentage of what there is. And that means you're still always on the lookout for what's going to be great to you and what you're going to think is awesome. And if you meet and have access to people who have a shared interest with you, even if it's like a single passion and you find each other on the internet and like some same thing in common, there's
and eventually have a huge falling out.
There's a decent chance that that person is maybe going to turn you on to something else that you will like that you don't know about. So hooking into those people who are sort of your cultural soulmates is a little bit easier in some ways. And they're not necessarily just going to sit there and talk to you about the same thing you met them talking about. So I think we felt like it was a good piece.
I think it's a really
interesting
piece.
And everybody should read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it is a very interesting.
Hopefully they should read it before they listen to this discussion.
Right.
And if you haven't seen it, it's in Wired.
It's called Wake Up Geek Culture, Time to Die.
Time to Die. All right. Anyway, it is the new year, and we thought we would quickly go around and have everybody maybe offer, if you have, a pop culture or cultural or artistic or just simply a personal New Year's resolution for the year. So you want to start, Stephen?
Do I? First of all, I would like to read a second book. I think reading the first book proved fruitful, and I look forward to reading a second one at some point in the first half of the year. Also, I really hope, and I don't know if this is a resolution as much as a hope, that I winnow out some of the bad TV that I watch in the hopes of watching more good TV.
Oh, good for you.
I would like to watch Friday Night Lights, which I've only seen the first episode of. And I would like to watch Parks and Recreation at Linda's insistence. I would like to watch Modern
Family. Oh, God, I thought this was going to say at Linda's house. Can't come to my house.
Hell no. But at the same time, everything is set on a scale. Where one thing is added, another must be subtracted. And so
if you're going to tell me that you're going to stop watching The Bachelor, we're just going to stop having this conversation right now. You're not allowed to stop watching The Bachelor.
Sounded like that's what he's building up to.
That was literally the exact thing that I was leading up to.
No.
I was thinking, I've already stopped watching Dancing with the Stars. It makes sense that I would cut its Monday Night Twin and stop watching The Bachelor. Linda and I hunkered down over beers and watched this week's premiere of The New Bachelor. I probably am going to end up watching it. Linda's shaking her head so sadly. The Bachelor in question is a dolt by the name of Brad Womack, who was The Bachelor several seasons ago and made a decision at the end of his season, once he had narrowed his choices down to two women, that he would marry neither of them.
Ah, yes.
So they decided to bring him back. He was very controversial. He was the most controversial and outrageous bachelor ever because he made a decision that most of us would describe as rational. And the entire two-hour episode was as it, everyone spoke to him and of him as if he had just gotten out of a 3-year prison sentence for running a dogfighting ring.
So what you're saying is at the end of the episode, the president forgave him.
And was then promptly criticized for doing so. It was absolutely the dumbest reality. I felt like it was the dumbest reality TV show I've ever seen, which I saw Married by America people.
It was not dumber than Married by America. Anyway,
was it dumber than The Littlest Groom? I feel like it might have been dumber.
So Stephen's resolution for 2011 is I will abandon my my best friend. I hope you could hear those finger quotes. I hope those finger quotes were audible.
Now, it should be noted that when Linda refers to my best friend, she's referring to Linda Holmes and not Brad Womack.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so...
I would like to be able to abandon Brad Womack without abandoning you, Linda Holmes. My guess is I will probably find time in my life for good television and bad television, and that I will continue to watch The Bachelor in all its grisly new forms.
Whatever.
So resolution lasted, what, 33 seconds?
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Trey Graham, why don't you come up with a resolution?
Well, one of my resolutions is to actually see all of the damn Best Picture Oscar nominees this year before the broadcast, which, believe it or not, the movies editor doesn't always get to do, because screenings happen during the workday sometimes, and while the critics get paid to go see the movies and the editors get paid to stay in the office and write headlines and photo captions. Not that I'm bitter.
That's a really good resolution. I want to try to do that this year, too. We should talk about the movies here on this podcast.
We should, in fact.
We should talk about more movies. Let's talk about more movies and less of The Bachelor.
Absolutely. My other major resolution for the year is kind of related. My other major resolution is to actually follow through on crap.
Nice.
You know, I mean, at least on the crap that's actually a good idea, as you know, or crap that I care about, as opposed to just movies. Yeah.
Okay.
To that end, I wanted to circle back on a thing we talked about earlier, to Hard Candy Christmas, which was my pop culture holiday memory, if you all recall.
Okay. Sure.
On the blog that week, a couple of the commenters asked about exactly what a Hard Candy Christmas might be, like specifically what does the metaphor mean and where it comes from. And I realized that I'd always assumed that I knew it, but I didn't really know for sure where the phrase came from. It sounds kind of Southern, but nobody I knew ever used it when I was little.
Okay.
So I called Carol Hall, who wrote the song, and she...
look at you following through.
Doing journalism. She told me that it was Larry Kane, the co-writer of the show's book, who brought her the phrase. And she said, and I'm going to read this to get it right... I'd never heard it, but Larry said, yeah, it's a Depression-era phrase. If you had five kids and a nickel, you could buy them all a piece of penny candy. For the longest time, I tried to write an explanation to the song, but I decided that was ridiculous. It had a feel to it, and I think that comes across. So that's that.
Wrong.
And,
evidently.
No, it did. I mean, again, I had the right basic assumption about what this thing meant. I just didn't know where it came from.
Well, and you still loved the song. So you still felt it.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We agree with her.
Yes. So that's that, and I'm sorry it took me so long to report back, but my nephews and I had some sledding to do over the holidays. And you know, and quite frankly, it was a kind of a hard liquor Christmas down there in Nashville, so I haven't exactly been focused.
All right, Glenn Weldon, your resolution.
When it comes to TV, I am no longer going to be the one strike and you're out guy, because I gather that's not how that's supposed to go, right, Stephen? You don't do the one strike, you're out?
In baseball, it is premature to call an out after one strike.
I am, and I think the word I'm looking for
elimination is what you call it.
The word I'm looking for here is Gandhi-like. I'm going to see two or three episodes of a thing before I write it out of my life. Because historically, I judge things by the pilot, and I know how unfair that is, but I just can't help doing it because there's a lot of stuff. There's just so much stuff. So my thing is pretty much the opposite of Stephen's. I'm not going to cut back. I'm going to try to open myself.
So you're going to watch three episodes of The Bachelor.
I was going to say, that is six hours of television.
The Bachelor, but you know what I'm going to go back to? Really? A show I dismissed out of hand after watching two episodes of it because I found it shrill and needy and trying way too hard.
Pop Culture Happy Hour.
I'm going to go back and give Cougar Town a shot.
Despite the name,
many people that I am very fond of are
this
big
is
fans
exactly
of
why, and not just on the Extra Hot Great podcast, although they are certainly ardent supporters
they
of
are.
The show. But other people have been. There's a thing about this show now, so I feel like I have to get on this.
I will join you in giving
Botoxed
that show another
bandwagon.
Track. I have the same reaction.
It's a deal.
All right. My New Year's resolution is relatively simple and straightforward. Unusual for me. I recently wrote my list of 50 things I really liked in 2010, and I found it so enjoyable to write that I decided I want to focus this year on recommending and finding things I like, and it doesn't mean that I will not still happily rip a strip off of things I don't like.
Like Steven.
Because that's part of the joy of being alive. But I do want to make sure that I focus the majority of my energy on locating and recommending and talking about the things that I like and that I think that people will get something out of and that I get something out of. And so my New Year's resolution, believe it or not, is positivity.
Ooh.
okay.
mine is actually to snicker derisively.
I could be positive.
I got that covered, Stephen.
I could be positive. He doesn't believe me.
It could happen.
Anyway, so that's my New Year's resolution. I really appreciate all of your warmth.
Hey, you undermined my resolution.
Well, yours was hostile to me. My resolution of positivity is not hostile to you, mostly.
Well, we have a metric for this. I mean, how many of the top 30 blog posts of 2010 were happy, positive ones, and how many of them were you ripping a strip off of something?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
We'll have to figure that out.
All right. Anyway, so finally, this week, as most weeks, we're going to end with something that is making us happy this week. So once again, we'll start with Stephen.
Oh, good heavens. All right. Well, one of the things that is making me happy is something that's making Linda happy, so I will set that aside for a moment. I will also briefly acknowledge that the Green Bay Packers are in the NFL playoffs.
Nice.
And that this delights me to no end, making me much more happy than the fate of my beloved Wisconsin Badgers.
I thought basketball season wasn't...
Football! Sorry.
Never gets old.
I spent my New Year's Day... I'm sure all of you guys did the same thing. I spent all of New Year's Day fuming about the media coverage of Wisconsin's tragic loss in the Rose Bowl, in which TCU, which beat Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl, which was favored
normally
to beat
Wisconsin, at least I care...
Yeah. Was favored to beat Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl, was suddenly hailed as, quote, a victory for the little guys.
Yes.
A victory. A favored team, the number 3 ranked team in the country, yes, beat my beloved Wisconsin Badgers. And you would think that Rudy single-handedly sunk the 3-point buzzer beater that beat the 1980 Soviet hockey team.
I know exactly what you mean. That phenomenon just really disrupted my digestion of the roast duck that a gentleman cooked for me the night before and almost disrupted my shopping experience that afternoon. So, yeah, I feel you.
I'm back on TCU. You. Telekinetic cat urine? What is TCU?
Yes, it stands for Telekinetic Cat Urine. Uh-huh. Also, Texas Christian University. Okay.
The Texas Christian University Horned Frogs.
Yes, Frogs, whose mascot...
is a horned frog. And I would point out that the sense in which it is perfectly safe to say that they were the underdogs is that in a showdown between a frog and a badger...
The frog has horns.
The badger has the weight advantage.
Well, that's what we're doing, Stephen. The badger has the weight advantage.
The horned frog would be considered the little guy or underdog or under frog.
Is it, is it one of those frogs that secretes the toxins?
Presumably.
Though? Because then the badger would lie down and wiggle.
Yeah. The badgers were the actual underdogs in the game by 2.5
points. It doesn't seem like
No, it's not making me happy. What is making me happy is that the Green Bay Packers are in the playoffs. Also, Wipeout is back. Thank you very much to the universe.
I didn't miss that.
I think the first ever thing that made Stephen happy was Wipeout.
Yeah. The first ever thing that ever made me happy in my life. Not just the first thing that made me happy on this podcast. So I'm happy that Wipeout is back.
The first thing to ever make Stephen happy in his life was Wipeout. Very good. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, what is making me happy this week is our nation's multimodal transport system.
Uh-huh.
You know, trains, planes, automobiles.
Nice.
Because said multimodal transit system is how you too will be able to access the two things that are actually making me happy this week.
Okay.
First up, the ever-growing canon of Klingon drama. That's Cassie.
Mike's just afraid Trey's going to leave it at that.
You have missed, I'm afraid, because we are now into the new year, you have missed the Klingon Christmas Carol, which is turning into an annual tradition, I gather, in St. Paul in Chicago. But I am authorized to tell you...
This is in the theater world?
Yes, this is in the theater world.
Okay.
I am authorized to tell you, and I am fairly certain that I am breaking actual news here about a thing that is happening at the Washington Shakespeare Company. This is a small D.C.-based company whose board president is one Mark Okrand, better known to the bigger geeks among us as... inventor of the Klingon language. And in late February, WSC will be restaging an event that was kind of a success for them back in September. It includes scenes from Hamlet, performed alternately in the heightened language of the immortal Bard of Avon, and then, for the purists, in the language of Worf and Kalis and Kumtak. It is a benefit, of course, so you should...
Dear Patton Oswalt, there are still dorks. Love pop culture happy hour.
This is a benefit, of course, so you should be prepared to pony
for
up.
For what?
For the theater company. But I, for one, believe
mankind.
That it will be...
Wait, this a benefit
gets
to
better.
Mankind.
This gets better, Stephen Thompson. Be patient. I, for one, believe that it will be worth not just the price of admission, but the price of your travel, because not only, as we all know, is Hamlet better in the original Klingon,
mm-hmm.
but because Stephen Fry, yes, that Stephen Fry, will be flying in to document this event for a BBC series called Planet Word, mm-hmm. for an episode about created languages. And he is going to perform in the Act 5 scene where the duel with Laertes happens. So, there. That is one thing that's making me happy.
Wow.
Are they going to have Batleths to duel with?
I certainly hope so. Uh-huh.
Is there another thing making you happy?
All right, the other thing that is making me happy, I read yesterday on Slash Film that Edgar Wright, of whom we have spoken approvingly on this podcast, is guest programming the new Beverly Cinema in L.A.
Yes, I saw that.
20 films, 18 days, starting January 14th, and it all starts with a triple feature of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
Yeah. Oh, good.
You can find the lineup, which is mostly stuff that Edgar Wright did not direct.
on the Edgar Wright Film Festival, starring Edgar Wright, and, programmed by Edgar Wright.
So the lineup is on Slash Film and on Edgar Wright's website, I think. And my favorite line in the Slash Film item is this one: Wright will be on hand at least one night during each of these double features to answer questions, do introductions, and just be a film-loving badass in general.
Nice.
So if you are in the LA area or you can get there, this is what you should be doing at some point between January 14th and the end of the month.
But what if I'm watching Hamlet performed in Klingon? Mm-hmm.
That's in February.
Oh. Well, and I actually want to add one other thing related to that item, which is Edgar Wright and I recently had a little exchange on Twitter about Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Yes. Yes.
Saw that.
Just saying.
Please pop culture read collisions, people.
NPR Monkey C on Twitter. Anyway, Glenn Weldon, making you happy this week?
Well, actually, I had something. I came in prepared. I have notes here. Look at me like a chump, like a jerk, bringing in all these notes. And it turns out, I'm just going to, let gone. Because I had this whole thing prepared about J.W. Kinsler's The Making of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back coffee table book, which is awesome for a variety of reasons.
Dear Patton Oswalt.
Exactly. It's a great book. But that is the thing that was making me happy last week. Something happened this morning which made me so happy that it trumped last week's thing. Ask me what it was.
What was it?
I cannot answer you because it is totally unknown to me what you said. And also very boring. That is a line from the AV Club Random Roles interview with Udo Kier. Mm. Udo Kier is the Luis Guzman. He's the German Luis Guzman. He makes
German Luis
films
Guzman
better. If he's in a movie, it's going to be a better movie. You're going to have a good time with that movie. He's done a lot of trashy films. He's done a lot of art films. He's done a lot of trashy art films. He's been in films by Uwe Boll, Fassbinder, Guy Madden, Werner Herzog, Lars von Trier, Rob Zombie. He's actually coming up in something. So he's all over the place. And this interview is so good. It's going to go up there in the pantheon with the Bronson Pinchot interview.
Because such a good interview.
It was such a good interview. But this one, ask me what auditioning is like.
What is auditioning like?
Audition is the worst thing. It's like cleaning furniture in a department store. Right? I mean, you can't argue with that, right? I've never auditioned for a thing in my life, but I'm reasonably certain it's like cleaning furniture in a department store.
I think we should team up with our old pals at the AV Club and do a podcast in which you read...
No.
You read their interview.
This thing, you will not get through this interview without inviting your friends to do a dramatic reading of it.
It's
so
amazing.
Great. Okay, last one. Ask me what friendship is.
What is friendship?
Friendship to me is if my friend needs my little finger to live, I'm going to have it cut off. I'm going to the hospital, they cut off my finger, and maybe I have a gold finger instead, and I become famous. Come on. It is just awesome. It's filled with this kind of stuff.
It's wonderful.
It is a wonderful
movie. We will link to it because it is amazing.
That is the AV Club. Just went live on Tuesday, the 4th of January. AV Club Random Rolls, Udo Kier.
That's excellent. I heartily endorse that. I did read it also. Making me happy this week. First thing is... You know, we always like to bring this podcast back around to Stephen's mother. And fortunately, I want to let all of you know that I did receive from Maggie, who joined us on our last episode, you'll remember, a gift, which memorialized some discussion that I had with commenters at some point on the website about the entire issue of Monkey C, the blog, and its relationship to the rest of NPR. And some of the things that I occasionally hear from... unhappy people about how it relates to the rest of NPR. And I had said at some point, I am going to get a wall hanging. I'm going to have that cross-stitched for me, that what we do here is beneath NPR's dignity. So Maggie Thompson gave me for Christmas an actual cross-stitched framed hanging, which says, simply in script.
In sort of a Whitman sampler.
In sort of a Whitman sampler blue script. This is beneath NPR's dignity. And that's all it says. And it is maybe the greatest gift of all time. It's pretty great.
My mother has given me many great gifts, including the very gift of life itself. But that was maybe the best gift I've ever seen. And it does occur to me, you know, Mom was on our podcast last time, and we neglected to give out her Twitter handle I figured we would give her a small measure of payback by suggesting that you all follow my mother on Twitter.
When you say
I feel like this should be a punchline of a joke. But you may follow my mother on Twitter at Thompson Maggie.
Yeah.
Maggie Thompson, creator of the This Is Beneath NPR's Dignity Cross Stitch, which I propose should come into the studio with us each time we record.
Well, you know, it is.
It is.
And we're so glad. And, you know, someone actually mentioned on Twitter just today that on the podcast I never mention How I Met Your Mother. So I just want to say to Stephen, this is the story of How I Met Your Mother, and she gave me a great gift. So I hope you're happy, person on Twitter. I have now mentioned How I Met Your Mother. The other thing that's making me happy this week, similar to Glenn, I had a wonderful thing that came across my line of vision today, and it is maybe the best thing that has ever happened in the history of the internet. And to understand it fully, you have to keep in mind that when I was merely an internet baby, or at least when my writing about television on the internet was a baby, I was following a site called Dawson's Rap, which later became a site called Mighty Big TV, which later became a site called Television Without Pity, which is where I worked prior to working at NPR. And Dawson's Rap originally was recaps of episodes of Dawson's Creek. And that was really the first site that I got into that had the sort of pop culture commentary that I later got interested in. So much of the focus of Dawson's Rap was on Dawson's Creek star James Vanderbeek and his giant cereal box shaped head. Trademark Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano, recappers of the time. And in the third season of Dawson's Creek ended with this scene in which Dawson, who was he was standing on a pier and he was dumped by his girlfriend, and she ran off and he was left on the pier, at which point his face contorted into a sobbing that Tara described at the time, and it's very accurate, as being the worst cinematic crying since Luke, I'm Your Father. That's not possible. That's not true. That's impossible. Anyway, so it became very much an internet meme, this photo. And in fact, by the time that episode was finished airing, practically, people were already posting these little images
of
his face contorting into this hilarious sob. And I thought it was something, dear Patton Oswalt, I thought it was something that only a very few people cared about or knew about. But today, on Funny or Die, James Vanderbeek posted or, you know, participated in a video that was posted that is an ad for a site called jamesvandermemes.com and he explains in this video.
Hi, I'm actor James Vanderbeek. If you're under the age of 20, odds are good you know me best from a 5-second clip of me crying that's circulating the internet. Yep. That's me on Dawson's Creek in a scene with Katie Holmes where her character dumps mine. You know, the more I saw it in website comment sections mocking the sadness of others, the more I realized what the internet was really demanding. More intense emotional close-ups of my face. So, I started a website where you can find short clips of me emoting dozens of other feelings at jamesvandermemes.com. Log on to vandermemes.com today and show the world what kind of Vander feeling you're having.
So he posted, and there is a real site, jamesvandermemes.com, where you can download, I think it's 20, different little GIF files of him doing different, like making, you know, a happy face and an angry face. And then some of them get very weird, like he gives the finger in one of them, and in another one of them he's dancing. And so it is so funny, and it is such a riff on himself of a type that I don't know that I assumed he was really capable of, especially not really referencing people making fun of your acting, which is not an easy thing to find the humor in. JamesVandermemes.com, video available on Funny or Die.
I'm looking at them right now.
They are hilarious. I give all props to James Vanderbeek. I am sorry for every time I ever laughed at them when they said that you have a head like a cereal box.
The stud wink. That's genius.
I'm sorry that I ever said that you had a giant head and all that stuff. And so this brings, I think, my pop culture career back around to a circular. Essentially, James Vanderbeek is to blame for the job I have now. So props to you, buddy.
Yep. Positivity. There
Thanks
we go.
Thanks for everything. I Positivity. Love that. Yeah. Props to Vanderbeek. Who knew? So that's what's making me happy this week is rediscovering my apparently buried love of Vanderbeek.
I've been ignoring everything that you've been saying as I scroll through jamesvandermemes.com.
And which one did you just find?
I just hit one that I cannot recite on this podcast.
Oh, nice. Anyway, so go check it out and see what's making Steven laugh so hard. And that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. And as we have discussed, you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C, where you can see me receive recommendations about Dexy's Midnight Runners from Edgar Wright. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, which Steven still insists upon rendering as
Trey with an E, then Graham like the cracker.
You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, that's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, that's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music. And as always, you can follow Steven's mother at Thompson Maggie. And that's it for Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks to all of you guys for being here, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Happy New Year to everyone, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.